26. I assume we have some folks. Jim Gardner, Tom Gallagher, I don't know if you want to come up together or you're both in favor of it. Morning, sir.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner with the law firm of Gardner & Gardner, and I appear before you today representing the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. PhRMA's membership consists of research-based pharmaceutical manufacturers which discover, manufacture, and market prescription drugs. House Bill 2426 is a very simple bill that does one thing. It makes technical and advisory committees that advise the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research subject to the Oregon Public Meetings Law. HB 2426 is a sibling of sorts of a bill that passed last session, House Bill 2945, a copy of which is attached to my testimony, which went through this committee and which some of you veterans may recall. I mention this because our experience in the aftermath of the passage of House Bill 2945 indicates why it would be good public policy to pass House Bill 2426. Last session, we were trying to open up to public scrutiny one particular OMAP advisory committee that had been meeting behind closed doors and engaging in discussion that we felt raised serious state and federal antitrust concerns. We wanted to let the sunshine in on those meetings so that the public, members of the press, and representatives of our industry could be kept informed of this particular advisory committee's deliberations. After the law took effect, and much to our surprise, frankly, we learned that there were numerous OMAP advisory committees dealing with extraordinarily important topics that we, and I dare say most members of the public and the healthcare industry, other than the attendees of particular advisory committees, did not even know existed. Turning to the Office of Health Policy and Research, there are a number of committees established pursuant to the mandate of last session's Senate Bill 819, which created the Practitioner-Managed Prescription Drug Plan for the Oregon Health Plan. We have significant concerns regarding the consistency with which timely information is shared concerning the meetings as well as the agendas of those meetings. Often a meeting is announced with no specific agenda. And because of the technical nature of the issues being considered and the fact that those best equipped to provide relevant information reside in many cases outside the state, the reasonable notice provisions of the public meetings laws make sense. In addition, what we cannot know, absent passage of House Bill 2426, is whether there are also OHPR advisory committees, formal or informal, intrastate or multistate, focused on prescription drug issues or focused on entirely different issues that have been meeting behind closed doors without the public's knowledge. Our experience in the aftermath of the passage of House Bill 2945 last session has induced a certain level of concern that this might have occurred or might be occurring, at least on an episodic basis. Passage of House Bill 2426 would have the salutary effect of making all such OHPR advisory committees subject to the Oregon Public Meeting Law. This would not only open such meetings to the public, but also ensure compliance with ORS 192.640's provision, which requires public notice, quote, reasonably calculated to give actual notice to interested persons, including news media which have requested notice of the time and place for holding regular meetings, as well as notice of the principal subjects anticipated to be covered at the meetings. In the past, certain OHPR advisory committees, while held publicly, have not been preceded by such notice, at least in our view. There was no opposition to this bill on the House side, and it passed unanimously on the House floor.
All right. Any questions? Mr. Chair. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. What happened to the opposition of the bill last session to House Bill 2945? I mean, I'm kind of curious, what's different this session?
I think that upon my, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I have taken pains to alert the new director of the Office of Health Policy to this bill to see if there were any opposition. I think, frankly, it may be simply a question of either change of administration or change of individuals, but or perhaps a recognition that this is good public policy.
Okay. Senator Ringo, actually, it's interesting that when we had the hearings in the 2001 session, it was pretty fascinating because we pretty much concluded that they were already subject to the open meetings law, but that it was unclear, so we were passing a statute that we believed to be somewhat redundant. And we had almost a hilarious discussion with the director then, or the person representing the agency, who all over the time and the effort it would take to actually publish a notice. And it became hilarious because it was so simple that they could have done it at any time and just simply had ignored the law.
I recall discussion from last year about the state believing that it needed to have some private discussions.
Right. And I'll tell you where I fall on these issues, is that I don't think there are very many places where the state or any government should conceal its activities. There are, we talk about the State Ads Insurance Fund. I have feelings about the proprietary information that they say exists there and the role of the legislature as a board of directors. So to me, it's the same kind of an issue.
Yes, Mr. Chair, does that apply to caucus meetings?
Well, actually, no. But there's a different separation of powers argument that goes along with that. All right. Mr. Gardner, thank you very much. And who do we have next? Gallagher, Tom Gallagher. Is Tom here? Tom Gallagher signed up. Tom Gallagher's not here. Going once, going twice. Public hearing closed. Work session. House Bill 2426.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I move that we adopt House Bill 2426 and send it to the Senate floor with a DFAS recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2426 be adopted and sent to the Senate floor with a DFAS recommendation. Did you include that in the consent calendar or not?
I did.
You did. And included in the consent calendar. Great.
That's a good one.
Yes. Okay. Any discussion? Any objection?
Well, I just want to state it was good policy last session, and it's obviously good policy this session.
Yes. All right. Thank you very much. Motion passes, and I'll carry the bill. All right. Next up, Senate Bill 259, public hearing. Mr. Landauer, Mr. Walter, yeah. City of Portland. Landauer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark Landauer. I'm with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. Thank you for scheduling Senate Bill 259 today, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before you. Senate Bill 259 was introduced at the request of the City of Portland. The bill would simply add a requirement that if a person is involved in civil judicial proceeding with this with a public body, or has filed a tort claim notice and asked to inspect or receive a copy of a public record, that person knows relates to a proceeding or notice, that person needs to submit the request in writing to the custodian as well as to the attorney for that public body. I've asked Ben Walters with the City of Portland's Attorney's Office to come and explain the reason why we've asked for this bill, and be happy to answer any questions after our presentation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Walters.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. The City Attorney's Office decided to draft this bill after having experiences while in litigation with opposing parties making public records requests and having information come out in a public records request the City Attorney's Office was not aware of or learned about while the City Attorney's Office was in the process of discovery. And the concern that comes up is that while we try to make informed recommendations to our client regarding litigation, if there are records that we're not aware of, then we're working on an unequal balance of information, and that doesn't allow us to try and resolve cases quickly and get them out the door if that is possible. And so what being aware that two sessions ago the state had asked and received an amendment to the public records law in which the state attorney general's office was to be advised of public records requests regarding tort claims that had been filed or litigation. We are simply asking that cities and other public bodies be afforded that same level of protection. The amendment does not seek to revise or extend any exemptions under the public records law. It merely requests that in litigation settings that other public bodies beyond the state be afforded the same protection that is otherwise set forth in current statute.
All right. Any questions? Senator Ringo?
Just a comment. You say it's you want a level field or you want it to be fair, and I don't quite track because you're claiming it's unfair because somebody obtains records from you and you don't know what records you have, but somebody else may know what records you have. And I don't see why it's really unfair to ask that you find out what records you may have as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, the City of Portland is an organization that's comprised of over 40 different bureaus and agencies and has approximately 5,000 plus employees. A public request could be submitted to an employee who's not aware that there's litigation pending, request could be processed and the records released without the city attorney's office having an opportunity to review the records. There may be information that's within there that is relevant to the litigation. There may not be. But to the extent that that occurs, the city attorney's office doesn't, we don't want to hold ourselves out as having superior knowledge of where all records may exist within the city. We have some inside knowledge as to that extent, but I don't think we hold ourselves out as being omnipotent or.
So you envision that, okay, these are public records, but you want the city attorney to have the opportunity to review them before they're released.
I'm not even sure that we're, excuse me, Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I'm not saying that in this example, in this case, that we would be asking to review all of those records ahead of time. It may be in some cases that we're just afforded notice so that we are aware of those records going out and we can ask that the agency provide us with copies as they go out. Some records are routine requests and there would be no need to have the city attorney's office involved in the review. Some of them may involve determinations on exemptions, and that would be a case where we would want to be involved.
Those determinations would take place whether there was litigation or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that's correct.
Right. So you don't need this notice to make that calculation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that's correct also.
I'm assuming the same instance occurs with the Attorney General, and the same rationale exists. The Attorney General is trying to get coordination from agencies to just make sure that they're tracking, because ultimately they have to defend the state, which includes all of its various agencies, and the same would be true for the City of Portland, probably a better example, because they do have all of these different subsidiary divisions, and et cetera. So, although I think Senator Ring is probably right, it could be handled internally, I suppose, but this works too. So, any other questions, concerns, issues? All right. Thank you very much. Andrea Meyer. Now, you didn't sign up one way or the other on this thing, so I'm waiting with bated breath to hear what you have to say.
Chairman, as members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Actually, in this case, I just raise a note of caution. Our public records laws are, and the right to the public to have access to them is a very important part of our government process. In fact, the section to which is being amended starts out with every person has a right to inspect any public record of a public body in the state except as otherwise expressed in the exceptions of what records are not available. And then it has this one provision. So it always makes us cautious when there are changes to this important law. Yeah, in addition, what it is setting up is if I seek documents and I'm not in litigation, I've not filed a notice of tort claim, I can get those documents without having to provide any notice to the attorneys. If I am and I'm requesting the same documents, I do. So it treats people differently based on their motive. And I want to take a moment to read one paragraph from the Public Records Attorney General Handbook. Generally, the identity, motive, and need of the person requesting access to public records are irrelevant. Interested persons, news media, representatives, business people seeking access for personal gain, busybodies on fishing expeditions, persons seeking to embarrass government agencies, and scientific researchers all stand on equal footing. So that concludes, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. But.
No, but thank you for the lesson. I appreciate
well.
That.
It's good.
Helpful. We can always depend on you guys to help us understand these things. All right. Thank you very much. All right. Any other discussion, questions? Senator Ferriola.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I've been thinking about Senate Bill 259 and the procedure that it sets up will require a whole bunch of different concurrent and sequential actions to take place, and I sort of question whether they'll actually happen. The notification requirement would require physically a piece of paper to be sent to the agency that's involved in a potential lawsuit. That piece of paper would have to go before the attorney in charge of the case, and they would make a decision at that point in time whether or not to seek the public records that have been requested by the potential litigant. And that presupposes that the notification will be sent, that it'll actually get to the right attorney, and that there won't be such a blizzard of these things if they don't become just part of the automatic file stuff that gets stuffed in the file. And at some point in time, if caseloads are anything like I think they are, the attorney's going to review the records that were requested the morning of the settlement meeting. And make a decision about whether or not those records are needed, and I think that's going to be a mad scramble to the courthouse to get stuff before the settlement. I'm not sure this really does prepare anybody better. Perhaps another approach would be to send all records that were requested by potential litigants, as long as they have to send a notification to the agency, why don't they just send all the documents that were requested? And we can really clog up the system. So I'm really questioning whether or not a separate notification will accomplish the objective, which is to put the attorneys in the case on point for records that were requested. It seems to me that the legal fiction is that the state or the city or the public entity knows what's in the public record. Obviously, that's not accurate because nobody can know what's in the public records. But to cause the circle of paper and an additional notification that somebody will have to review in a timely manner to trigger a decision whether or not to go get those documents and do all that before a settlement discussion is defeated utterly by the fact that people will go get these records before they make the intent to sue notification. They'll make the decision on the, based on the information that they gather before they file the lease pendants. And if that's the case, the trigger doesn't fire. Doesn't you know the trigger effectively drops a hammer on an empty chamber. So I just think the bill needs to be thought about a little more. And if there is a requirement for some better notification, maybe we create the duty in the person that intends to sue to notify the agency or send copies of the documents. But I'm not sure how this bill provides any additional protection for a public entity that may or may not be engaged in a lawsuit. I mean, a lot of these records are going to be requested before the lease pendants, and a lot of these records are going to end up in the decision not to litigate. So I'm not really sure what additional protection this offers the city.
Well, I think one of the things we could do is contact the Attorney General's office and see if we can get Pete Shepherd or Hardy come over and tell us what the law change does for them and how it's helpful to the state. I mean, that may give some guidance there, but I mean, to me, it's really tough when your committee's not even listening to you.
Sorry. Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Ringo.
Sorry. I'm a little bit ambivalent about it, but there was an interesting comment made during the testimony how an attorney can look closer to see if any exemptions apply. And I think that's what's really going on here, is that the city wants an additional opportunity to look to see if there's anything damaging in the records. And, you know, the reality is that in the course of litigation, both sides are supposed to turn over everything that's relevant or might be relevant, even if it would be damaging to them. Well, it's not unheard of for, in certain circumstances, damaging documents to be somehow put in another folder or lost or not produced, you know, and that would be unethical for an attorney to do that, but it has happened on occasion where, gee, the damaging document just doesn't seem to get to the other side. That's why even the comment about, well, we might look closer to see if there are exemptions to the public records law, that's what I think is going on. They want to take a really close look to see whether, gee, maybe there is something in the file that would be damaging and therefore they don't want to turn over.
But, and you may be right, Senator Ferriola may be right, that the system just doesn't work. But I guess, not speaking to the city of Portland, but it seems to me they're just trying to get access to information that may be scattered around.
Understand. Well, it makes it easier for them to do their job in defending the case. Because
right.
Otherwise, they don't know what requests have been made.
All right. So, given the scattered discussion that we've had, I think we'll close the public hearing on this. And we'll hold on to it for a little bit. We do have a letter submitted to us by the City of Eugene indicating their support for the bill also. All right. So now we'll move into the public hearing on another stellar bill, Senate Bill 297, which has been signaled to me there are other issues, and we've got a long list of persons who'd like to testify on this. Justin Baxter, you're signed up first, New York State Bar. If you'd come up, let's open the public hearing.
Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. I'm Justin Baxter of Portland. I'm appearing on behalf of the Consumer Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, and with this endorsement, I'd like to thank you and members of the committee for allowing me the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 297, which limits certain provisions in consumer contracts, including binding arbitration clauses. Mr. Chair, David Corey of Sweet Home signed a lease agreement with a Beaverton car dealership on a gentleman's handshake that he could review his finances and rescind the transaction if the lease payments exceeded his budget. The dealership later reneged on the deal, but Mr. Corey was saved because the bank wouldn't approve his loan. The dealer then forged Mr. Corey's initials onto the lease agreement, increasing the amount of the payments to get the bank to approve the loan. Mr. Corey brought a claim under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in circuit court, but was forced into arbitration based on an arbitration clause hidden in the fine print on the backside of his lease agreement, similar to Exhibit C in my printed materials. The arbitrator found that the dealer had indeed forged Mr. Corey's initials onto the lease agreement, yet the arbitrator would not let Mr. Corey out of the lease. The arbitrator let the dealer off with a mild slap on the wrist, a $1,200 fine. Mr. Chair, David and Susan Young of Portland were cheated by a now-defunct manufactured home dealer in southeast Portland. There's evidence that the national lender that funded the deal knew of the seller's ongoing fraud and was complicit in approving loans to purchasers that should not have qualified for loans. The lender profited by selling the loans as asset-backed securities and by servicing the loans. Mr. and Mrs. Young also brought claims in circuit court under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and other consumer protection laws, but they were forced into binding arbitration pursuant to an arbitration agreement presented on a take-it-or-leave-it basis with no real opportunity to negotiate the terms. That agreement is attached in my printed materials as Exhibit A. This arbitration clause seeks to rewrite the Unlawful Trade Practices Act by prohibiting punitive damages, attorney's fees, and class actions. The arbitration clause selected the commercial rules of the American Arbitration Association, which are very costly. Over a year after the judge ordered arbitration in this case, the Youngs have lost their home, thousands of dollars, and still are waiting for their day in court or their arbitration. Oregon has enacted consumer protection laws, like the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. These laws protect consumers by prohibiting certain unlawful business practices. These laws also ensure a level playing field for those businesses in Oregon, the many Oregon businesses that operate lawfully. Because there are not enough resources for the state government to police every single business and respond to every single complaint, consumers are empowered to bring cases in court as private attorney generals to seek redress. However, in arbitration, the judge and jury are replaced by an arbitrator, and there is virtually no appeal from the arbitrator's decision. As I mentioned, arbitration can be very expensive. The consumer must typically pay for some or all of the arbitrator's hourly fees, which can range from $150 up to $300 per hour. Additionally, consumers may be required to pay high administrative fees to the arbitration services. Thus, a consumer must pay thousands of dollars up front just to have his case heard. Additionally, as I mentioned in the case of David and Susan Young, the drafters of these arbitration agreements have begun to rewrite the laws that this body has passed. For example, Exhibit A says not only must a dispute be arbitrated, but the purchasers, the borrowers, cannot recover remedies which they would be otherwise entitled to recover, punitive damages, attorney's fees. Additionally, consumer groups are not the only groups that are concerned by the proliferation of binding arbitration agreements. Indeed, the National Auto Dealers Association, the industry trade group that acts on behalf of independent auto dealers across the country, lobbied Congress this very last year for a bill limiting the application of arbitration agreements between the dealers and the manufacturers. This law that was passed in November, called the Arbitration Fairness Act, said that arbitration agreements between manufacturers and dealers were enforceable only if the parties agreed to arbitrate after the dispute arose. Testifying on behalf of the NADA, Gene Fondren, the president of the Texas Automobile Dealers Association, said, "The motor vehicle manufacturers appear to support arbitration as a handy device to enforce adhesive, unfair, onerous, and very difficult portions of their agreement. The truth of the matter is what dealers tell us about arbitration is not so good. The dealership agreement with an auto manufacturer is, in Mr. Fondren's words, a classic example of a contract of adhesion. It is not negotiated. It is handed to the dealer who is expected to make or already has made a substantial investment on a take-it-or-leave-it basis." The commissioner of the Virginia DMV, Richard Holcomb, testified before Congress, "This practice forces dealers to submit their disputes with manufacturers to arbitration. As a result, dealers are forced to waive access to judicial or administrative forums, substantive contract rights, and statutorily provided protection. This practice," Mr. Holcomb says, "clearly violates the dealer's fundamental due process rights and runs counter to the basic principles of fairness." I would also encourage this committee to amend one portion of Senate Bill 297, the section that reads arbitration clause. I would encourage the committee to amend that to read forum selection clause. Forum selection clause is a broader term that encompasses arbitration clauses, but the reason I would do this is because when Georgia-based Earthlink purchased local internet service provider Teleport and failed to provide its services, It injured approximately 50,000 consumers, including thousands of consumers in Oregon. Those consumers attempted to bring claims in a federal court in Oregon. And when they did, Earthlink attempted to enforce a tiny clause at its website that required the consumers to bring their claims in Georgia. If that clause had been enforced by the judge, Oregon consumers would have been required to fly 3,000 miles across the country to enforce to bring their legitimate claims. In conclusion, in a time of budget cutbacks, the state simply does not have sufficient resources to hire enough attorneys, investigators, or staff to police every single business, nor would it want to. Rather, the system of consumers acting as private attorneys general has served this state well for decades and should be permitted to continue to do so. However, if consumers are deterred from pursuing legitimate claims by high costs, limitations on their statutory remedies, or by absurd arbitration decisions, Oregon risks a rise in the unregulated, unrestrained, Enron-like business practices. For these reasons, I strongly urge the member of this committee to vote in favor of Senate Bill 297.
All right, Mr. Baxter, I've got a question for you. It's been told to me that the federal law preempts laws like this, Federal Arbitration Act. Can you talk to me about that and why you think this law would be constitutional or why that this law would be permissible under that act?
I can, Chairman. One of the reasons for my suggested amendments replacing the language binding arbitration clause with forum selection clause is to avoid that problem. While the Federal Arbitration Act has broad preemptive powers, courts have construed it, including the Supreme Court, to allow states to pass laws of general applicability. That is, if the law affects all contracts, then it is permissible, even if it prevents arbitration.
All right, and I'm asking this kind of to the air and to the staff counsel. I want to know a little bit more about arbitration clauses and the binding nature of those things and an individual's right to jury trial under the Oregon Constitution. If you have a response, I don't know, but it just
absolutely. Article 1, Section 10 or 18, I believe, in the Oregon Constitution. Section 17, Article 1, Section 17 of the Oregon Constitution provides that in all civil cases, the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate, even stronger than the language in the Federal Bill of Rights. This is a way of contractually waiving a consumer's constitutional right to a jury trial. That's my response.
Well, I think that's a good one. I guess I'm now wondering, with respect to states' rights issues, federal preemption under the Arbitration Act, and on constitutional law, that states can provide a greater protection in their constitutions than does the federal constitution. And so, it's interesting. I mean, it's an interesting power, issue between the states and the federal government. I'm just wondering where we are in terms of our legal groundwork, because I might ask counsel to do a little bit more research on that subject. So, okay. Any other response before?
If I may respond, Chair, Mr. Chair, the law is the evolving law of arbitration points to state laws. Though the Federal Arbitration Act is a federal statute, the courts have construed it to relate to state laws of contracts, and that's where the state legislation and state legislatures come in. For example, New Mexico has passed a law limiting arbitration in consumer contracts, and that's what the guidance is from the federal courts, is that states are to define the law of contracts in general, with regard to these arbitration contracts, and that is how we determine whether an arbitration clause is enforceable.
All right. Thank you. Other questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Baxter, thank you for your presentation. It was very good this morning, and your supporting materials. I have two questions. You gave the example of the National Independent Auto Dealers going to Congress and getting a law passed that gave them more freedom from the arbitration clause. Could I ask you if you're aware, do the independent auto dealers like that same sort of provision when it comes to their customers? Or do they want arbitration?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I've included in the printed materials exhibit C, which is an example of the standard Oregon Auto Dealers Association contract. This is backside of a form contract that's used by many Oregon auto dealers, and you'll see about midway down the page, sort of buried in the fine print, paragraph 11 is an arbitration option. It's my understanding that nearly all, or I'll say most, auto dealers in Oregon use either this clause or something very similar. They do seek to enforce these in order, I assume, to avoid the scrutiny of judges and juries and move these cases into arbitration. As you know, with this law before Congress that was signed by President Bush in November, I think we should take the NADA at its word that these arbitration agreements are not good policy when they're entered into with an imbalance of bargaining power. That is, in the example that the auto dealers gave, the strong bargaining position of the manufacturers as opposed to the weak bargaining position of the dealers. You could take that exact argument and show that there is a very strong bargaining position by the dealers with respect to the weak bargaining position of the purchaser, the consumer, who has little opportunity to negotiate. And if they want to buy a car, they're virtually obligated to sign one of these arbitration clauses.
My second question then follows up on that. You understand that ADR is really a useful tool, can be a useful tool. My understanding of what you're trying to do here is at least give the consumer the option to choose alternative dispute resolution, binding arbitration, as opposed to a jury trial or civil lawsuit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, absolutely. Alternative dispute resolution is appropriate in most circumstances, but this is really an issue of free choice. You know, where two parties of equal bargaining power decide we want to resolve these this dispute between us through arbitration instead of in court. That's appropriate and legitimate. The problem is when we have these sort of boilerplate contract provisions hidden in fine print that very often consumers don't even see, let alone understand. I believe that the clause in the Exhibit C, the first sentence is approximately 123 words long. I don't expect myself, let alone an unsophisticated consumer, to grasp the significance of this lengthy paragraph of legal jargon.
And I would agree with you, Mr. Baxter. There are a few of us who are as anal as I who read everything in the contract because it's important to find out what you're signing. The bill seems a little bit broad. I think that what we need to do is make sure that contracts, if they have that clause, that we don't make it, we give the option to agree to either opportunity, and then it should be disclosed. And I think that's what you're asking for. It is. Thank you.
So if I'm following this discussion, it seems to me that these kind of contracts tend to be used in consumer purchases like automobiles. But I suppose if physicians wanted to get around tort issues, they could simply have a consumer contract that included an arbitration clause that would do the same thing.
Mr. Chair, it's sort of beyond the scope of my prepared remarks, but it is my understanding that in some states, HMOs and physicians have used arbitration contracts prior to rendering services.
All right. So again, if I'm understanding correctly, I think the question is whether or not somebody enters into a contract knowing that that clause is present there and that they consent to the terms of that arbitration agreement. And that, to me, is a general concept in law that people do things knowingly, willingly, without coercion, without being deceived into or entering into a contract without some specific knowledge that they're binding themselves in some way. And that seems to be a fundamental concept in law. So, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks for coming today, Justin. Proponents of arbitration usually argue that it's quicker, cheaper, easier for all parties. And in my experience, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But I just wondered whether you could comment on you're saying it's expensive. When is it expensive? When isn't it expensive?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo. I would like to address this point of cost. Again, in the context of recognizing that we do have a narrowing budget, and we are concerned about additional costs in court, I can give you a good example of how arbitration can be much more expensive for the litigants and for the state system. At the beginning of my presentation, I told the committee about Mr. and Mrs. David Young, who brought a case in circuit court relating to the purchase of a manufactured home. They've been pushed into binding arbitration, and it's been almost 4 years since they first bought their home, and they're still waiting for their day in court for a hearing before an arbitrator. By contrast, John and Michelle Way brought a nearly identical claim against the same parties in circuit court, but they did not have, they fortunately did not sign that binding arbitration clause that is Exhibit A. Their case was set for trial, and it settled several months after the judge denied the motion to arbitrate. So that case has gone away and requires no more state administration, no more expense on the part of any of the parties. It's done. By contrast, David and Susan Young and many other consumers who have similar claims pending in arbitration are still waiting. And that's, you know, a drain on the parties, and ultimately the state will be called upon to, for example, enter judgment, potentially consider appeals, though appeals are limited in arbitration. As I say, those cases go on. And so, Senator Ringo, that's an example of arbitration being much longer and much more expensive than a case running through traditional court means.
Could you also explain to the committee, when somebody signs a binding arbitration clause, who gets to choose the arbitrator? I mean, who's choosing the person that's making the decision?
Typically, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, typically arbitration is a matter of contract. And so we look to the contract to determine who the arbitrator is or who picks the arbitrator. As you can see in Exhibit C, what typically happens is the drafter of the arbitration clause picks, and the consumer does not. So in the case of Exhibit C, this drafter has chosen the Arbitration Service of Portland. And I'm sort of reticent to cast aspersions towards any particular party, but you know, when A drafter of this type of clause has the power to pick. I would suggest that that power could be abused to pick an arbitral forum that is more favorable to the drafter, in this case, the business.
Okay. Thank you. Again.
I guess if I could just make a comment. Currently, the law in Oregon is that if you file a civil lawsuit for $50,000 or less, I mean, in most counties, it goes into a mandatory court-supervised arbitration program, and the court prints out a list with five names. And so the parties get a look at those five names and decide which ones they like, which they don't like, and pick one. And it's inexpensive, and it usually resolves the case because people feel like they really did get an independent arbitrator. In the system that Mr. Baxter just described, where because of the fine print, it designates which company is going to do the arbitration, and then that the person that runs that company designates which person is going to be the arbitrator, essentially is going to decide the case. It's not really put into a random system where it seems to be fair. They're picking a judge that's a ringer and is going to rule for the auto dealership, in at least in this case. And that's what I think is one of the most unfortunate aspects of these mandatory arbitration clauses, is they steer the decision making to somebody that is not impartial. But that's just a comment. But thank you for coming today.
All right. Thank you. One last question for you. Line 17 of the bill, this applies to contracts entered into before the enactment of this bill. If that was to happen, that seems to violate contract law principle. Can you address that issue?
I don't have a direct comment other than the principle of the law, which is that consumers have more or less been duped into fine print boilerplate terms without their without being aware of either the clause or the significance applies to contracts entered before the statute. Whether they signed it before today or after today, the contract still would have been one of adhesion entered into between parties of unequal bargaining power.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Baxter. We're going to take a 5-minute break and recess so I can go get some more coffee because... to order. Okay, great. Next up, Bruce Rothman, Oregon Consumer League. Mr. Rothman.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Consumer League. We have a membership of some 300 plus in the Portland metropolitan area. It's a nonprofit corporation, and the purposes of the charter are set forth in my written remarks. I currently serve on the board of directors of the Oregon Consumer League, and my testimony and remarks today are directed in support of Senate Bill 297 on behalf of the Oregon Consumer League. My background is a retired attorney. I am currently occupying emeritus active status with the Oregon State Bar. In the past, I've served as a judge pro tem, and I'm currently active as an arbiter in the Portland metropolitan area. In addition, I do voluntary pro bono representation of indigent consumers and disabled children who have been denied Social Security benefits by the federal government. My work on behalf of consumers in the Portland area is largely centered around issues of auto fraud by auto dealers. My voice is a little strange. This is my maiden voyage. And
that's quite all right.
I'm not particularly familiar with your procedures, and I was dragooned last night about 8 o'clock to appear and prepare some written materials.
You can relax. We're pretty relaxed here.
Okay.
Not like a court.
Well, I think by the time I finish my remarks, some of us will not be relaxed. I think, on behalf of the Oregon Consumer League, that this bill's passage will have a dramatic remedial effect on a widespread abuse of auto dealers and their adhesive sales agreements, which provide for mandatory binding arbitration agreements, which pre-select the arbitration association with exclusive jurisdiction to decide any dispute under the contract. Senator Ringo raised this issue, and I think it's one of the most important issues. The chair also raised a question: how is it that people sign arbitration agreements and are not aware that they signed them when they purchase a vehicle? And the answer to that is the technique of how these documents are presented, usually about 99% by the car dealers. And what they do, and there's a term of art in the auto industry called fanning the documents or palming the documents. And what happens is the documents are set in a fan with the signature line highlighted, obscuring the top document is obscured by the bottom document, and so on. All the documents are obscured from the consumer. The consumer buys a car, not a Chevrolet, not a Ford. He buys a payment, by and large. Most people buy a payment today. What they're concerned about and their focus during the whole negotiations of the car deal is how much is the payment. So what they are concerned about is the payment, and they want to make sure that's the case. But they're not really aware of all the disclaimer clauses that they are signing, the arbitration agreements that they are signing. And what happens is the documents are set before the consumer in this fashion, one on top of the other in a fan. The person who is requesting his signature of the consumer will point to the yellow area that's highlighted with his hand on top of the document, pointing where he should sign. He immediately turns the document over. The hand goes back on top of the document, and the person signs where it's highlighted, and so on, through all of the documents. 99 times out of 100, the consumer is never aware of the document's contents that he's signing, only that these are the documents that he must sign in order to buy a car on time. Now, this bill properly places the burden proof on the auto dealers to show that the consumer had an opportunity to accept the contract without the provision. This would necessarily entail full disclosure to the consumer of the costs and the process of arbitration and what is involved in accepting arbitration over court litigation. Arbitration in the Portland metro area, as presently required by car dealers in their mandatory arbitration clauses, is far more costly, in many instances prohibitively so, than the court-mandated system. In addition, it is patently unfair to consumer as the auto dealer selects the arbitration association, which in my judgment is calculated to deny the plaintiff an impartial forum. Many of the Portland metropolitan area arbitration clauses and sales agreements designate in the sales contract the Arbitration Service of Portland as the arbitration forum, which has its own rules of procedure and selection of arbiters. The agreement that the consumer signs, which he doesn't really know or understand that he's signing an arbitration agreement for Portland Arbitration Service, provides that the arbitration shall be impartial. This is far from the case. And the exhibits which I have attached for the committee's consideration, specifically Exhibit 2, shows what the Arbitration Service of Portland does to defeat, in our judgment, the rights and interests of the consumer. The Exhibit 2 is an advertisement that we obtained in discovery that Arbitration Service of Portland provides automobile dealers to solicit their business. The important part of it from our perspective is the question in this solicitation piece asked by Arbitration of Service in the contents of the document. The question is, how does arbitration act as a shield for my business? The answer, because it discourages frivolous lawsuits by removing the tantalizing attraction to a consumer of a potentially sympathetic jury, and it dramatically increases the likelihood of a successful and less expensive defense. By having the matter decided by a truly impartial person who poses expertise in the subject of the area of the dispute. ASP has brazenly advertised to businesses in the past that using ASP's services dramatically increases the likelihood of a successful defense. ASP cannot seriously hold itself out as an impartial forum when its own promotional literature promises that using ASP arbitration services will act as a shield for its business, and that businesses will presumably receive better treatment in its arbitration than it will from a judge and jury. It's one thing to advertise to potential users of its services that the costs of arbitration are less over litigation, which they are not, certainly not with ASP or the American Arbitration Association, yet quite enough, another thing to say dramatically increases the likelihood of a successful defense. The issue as to mandatory arbitration clauses is a very important issue to the Consumer League of Oregon and the consumers of Oregon. And they have, in our judgment, been shortchanged, and they have not had impartial forums in the Portland metropolitan area. The materials which I have set forth go on to explain in some length the reasons why I feel so, which I will not burden you with as you have the written materials, but to say that this is a very important issue. The reform of arbitration in this state is long overdue, and we request your favorable consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any questions?
There are no questions. Okay. Again, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony and also the submission of the documents. It's very helpful. Next up, Leonard Hagan and John Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, before you today representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, State Farm Insurance Companies, North Pacific Insurance Company, Contract Responding Insurance Company, American International Group, Standard Insurance Company, and AT&T Wireless. And with me is Lynn Hagan, who is an attorney with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and he has prepared a very brief one-page document for the committee's use, and ask Mr. Hagan to give you an oral version of why in the insurance field that this bill would cause extreme havoc. As you know, all insurance documents are pre-printed by law and approved by a regulator prior to their use. Mr. Hagan.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I've already been introduced. I should let you know that I am an attorney and I do work with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. My capacity now is as manager of legislative affairs. I started with Regents in the legal department. What I'm going to talk to you about this morning, we've heard a lot about arbitration, and it sounds like from the proponents that the arbitration is the key issue. But what I want to bring to your attention is the way the bill is drafted, there may be some severe unintended consequences with Senate Bill 297. And I'll direct your attention to start with to Section 1C. It does say the provision is an arbitration. It's talking about provisions that would presume to be void if, and then A is the standardized printed form, B is one party drafted it, the other person had to accept or reject it. Then C, the provision is an arbitration clause, choice of law clause, and then this is the part I want to talk about, or any other clause that is not express and conspicuous and does not define the rights or obligations of the parties. Senate Bill 297, in a nutshell, is addressing contracts of adhesion. We've heard that term several times. And a contract of adhesion is where one party drafts a contract. The other party has two choices, accept the contract or reject the contract. Contracts of adhesions, many feel and are supported by the courts as good public policy. Think about your daily lives. If you had to sit down and enter into negotiations for the various contracts that we sometimes take for granted, you turn on your computer, you use software, you're surfing on the internet, you use programs on the internet, quite often you'll see licensing agreements. If you had to sit down and negotiate those agreements, it would take a lot of time and it wouldn't be cost effective by any means. Other contracts just that come immediately to mind, banking agreements and insurance policies. Our subscriber contracts, our insurance policies, we use the term subscriber contracts, would fall under 297, and they are contracts of adhesion. That's established law. Like I said, courts support contracts or uphold contracts of adhesions because they do represent some sound public policy. In return, to protect the consumers, courts do a number of things. And I mentioned this in my second paragraph of the letter, but in return for, because courts know that one party gets to draft, the other person had to accept or reject, any ambiguity in that contract is construed against the drafting party. So courts use that legal tool. The other thing they will do is they imply good faith and fair dealing in all contracts. You can be held for bad faith if you don't stand behind your contract. Also, if there are terms that are deemed unconscionable by a court, then usual and customary or industry standard terms would replace those terms. So courts do an awful lot now to protect consumers with contracts of adhesion. Now, as an insurance company, we have another There's another consumer protection piece, a very significant piece, and that's Department of Consumer and Business Services, DCBS. We're heavily regulated, and our contracts, ironically, must be standardized. We have to have we have to get DCBS approval on our contracts. So we have to pre-file them, then they're approved. That's the contract we have to use. You can imagine the type of discrimination, et cetera, that may go on if we had to negotiate contracts with each policyholder. It simply wouldn't work. We're also, as an insurance company and other insurers licensed in Oregon, are subject to the Unfair Trade Practices Act. So there's that as well. So it's heavily regulated with abundant consumer protections. As an insurer, we also have individual rights, and in the insurance code, there's a two-tier grievance process. The bottom part of my letter, some of the bullets, I mentioned our subscribers. We represent or insure 1.2 million Oregonians, and I mentioned already that we are required by law to use standardized subscriber contracts. Another thing in Senate Bill 297, it does create a rebuttable presumption if a party had the opportunity, and we heard this in the proponent's testimony, if you have the opportunity to sit down and discuss a provision and you agree to it, there's a rebuttable presumption and it wouldn't be void. But we're required to use a standardized contract, so, and we don't have the opportunity to sit down with all of our subscribers and negotiate the policy. So we wouldn't have the benefit of the rebuttable presumption. And I think my final comment is, again, going back to my first comment, that this bill is very broad, and parties simply won't be willing or will be very, very reluctant to enter into contracts if you don't know what the terms are going to be. If you can't determine what terms will survive and what terms will not, you're going to be reluctant to enter into that contract. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, Senator Ringo?
Thank you. Thank you for testifying, Mr. Hagan. You repeated on a number of occasions how many adhesion contracts you entered just because of form contracts. I don't think anybody wants you to have to not use form contracts. It's just that we don't want you to use those contracts to deprive somebody to a right to a jury. I mean, that's and I didn't hear anything you testified talk about the mandatory arbitration clause and whether somebody might have a right to a jury.
You're correct. I didn't testify to that. And Senator Ringo, Chairman, because I think the bill is so much broader than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned we do have the grievance process as an insurance company, so we don't have the arbitration issue per se. But when you look at this bill, if this bill becomes law and then we're later looking in the statute to see what it does, you're right, it would not prohibit adhesion contracts, but as an insurance company, we would be very reluctant. And I'm not sure how we would underwrite a contract that we wouldn't know which provision in that contract, in our determination and or our members' determination, is not expressed conspicuous and does not define the rights or obligations of the parties.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, from my standpoint, I think you're entirely right. I don't know what that means either, and it needs to be rewritten. And I'm willing to bet you the proponents of the bill would rewrite it. So rather than focus on the parts of the bill that may be ambiguous, I'd rather focus on the issue of the arbitration clause and whether you would really oppose, because, and I noticed in your written testimony you never discussed the arbitration clause. I'm wondering whether that's an important issue to you.
It sounds like John wants to have a comment here too. It's an important issue, but as I mentioned, I looked in one of our contracts this morning. We have many. But I don't believe we use arbitration provisions in our subscriber contracts because it's handled through the regulatory side.
I see.
Now, our policies go into great detail on the process that you use if you have a grievance or a complaint. Then there's a mechanism set up to handle that. So it's true. Our issue isn't so much the arbitration as it is everything else that we really can't get our arms around.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Starr, any questions? Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes.
Mr. Powell. Chairman Minnis and Senator Ringo, I think it would be clear, and we'll provide more information. I think it's fairly clear from the way, quote, arbitration works in insurance, that it would not or should not come under the purview of a bill like this, because in auto insurance, I know the only time you can get to, quote, binding arbitration under the contract is when both parties agree to that. So you have a right to get to a jury. And in health insurance, we passed a bill last session that not only do you have an appeal right within the insurance policy itself, but you have a right to external appeal to a group that contracts with the regulator to provide that kind of service. So your claim of unfairness within that policy can go to an independent group for resolution. So I think in the sum of it, that if the bill does go forward, that it should exempt those types of contracts that are not part of the problem.
I think that's a fair point.
All right. Thank you, Senator Ringo. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask if either of these gentlemen can tell me what is Hobson's choice.
I'm sure Mr. Hagan knows.
What is Hobson's choice?
What is Hobson's choice?
I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I have the answer.
All right.
I
knew you
might
probably would.
Hobson's choice is defined as an apparently free choice that offers no real alternative after Thomas Hobson, an English keeper of livery stable, from his requirement that customers either take the horse nearest to the stable door or none. In these pre-printed contracts, there really isn't a choice. I mean, here's the deal. People do business. This is the way we do business. If you want to do business with us, press hard. Three copies signed here. And even though there may be a great deal of time explaining the clauses of the contract, I don't know of a situation where a consumer is free to just X out a part of the contract and initial it because of these pre-printed forms. Some are required by law. Others are just the way we do business in the world. Those would be the systems house kind of contracts that people see, auto dealerships and so forth. And I for one, believe arbitration is in those contracts to protect both the consumer and the vendor. But it seems like we have a little trouble getting the concept of equity without eliminating access to the courts, and that's what this issue is. So I guess the question that I have to ask is, given the fact that most consumers don't have the choice to X out a clause in a contract if they think it's offending, how do we then balance these two principles? You've got access to legal protection, but you're bound by a binding arbitration clause. How do those things go together?
We've had some sidebar discussions. I'm sorry, yes, Senator Farioli and Mr. Chair. We've had some discussions already listening about the arbitration issue. I would have to do some more legal research and analysis to really answer your question for you, because at this time I don't know what that balance is. I know there's a Supreme Court case, I believe it's Lakin in Oregon, that would weigh in on this. We've talked about the Federal Arbitration Act. Where that balance would be, I don't have the answer for you this morning.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I utterly believe that arbitration is a good thing, and I think it's put in there for equal protection of both vendors and consumers. I'm unhappy with the idea that arbitration can also be used as a weapon, that you can be forced into it at some occasions, and it can be more litigious in nature than access to the courts. So I'm interested in seeing how this issue gets balanced.
All right.
I'm glad it's before the committee.
All right. Good. And the chair tends to agree with you. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We have from our class on here, Atlanta Butterfield and Bob Morgan, should be Safeco Insurance Company.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mona Butterfield. I'm here today representing Safeco Insurance Company. With me is Bob Dorband. Bob is the managing attorney for Safeco here in Oregon, and he's going to give you the perspective of a property casualty insurance company.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Safeco is concerned about Senate Bill 297. And we wonder exactly how it's intended to affect insurance contracts. Although it appears to be aimed at other kinds of consumer contracts, it would seem to apply as drafted to insurance contracts. I would echo Mr. Hagan's testimony on this point, that the language in particular of Section 1C regarding the any other clause aspect of the bill would subject to voiding virtually every provision of a standard insurance contract. Contracts of insurance are regulated by statute. Safeco wonders whether Senate Bill 297 envisions that the UIM and PIP arbitration provisions, as well as any other provision of the insurance contract that is required by statute to be in every policy of insurance, would not be affected. It would open the door to litigation, to questioning provisions of insurance contracts that have been long accepted, and we would appreciate clarification on that point. Thank you for your attention and concern.
All right. So your issue is the broadness of the bill and how it might apply to terms.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Undefined. Okay.
Sure.
Senator Ringo.
Well, I think that's a good point, in that we ought to rewrite the bill so it doesn't impact the PIP and UIM statutes.
But let me ask this question. Would you agree that consumers are entering into contracts freely and voluntarily with some reasonable level of knowledge of the terms of the contract?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I, as an individual consumer, as an attorney, I do not believe that consumers are completely aware of what they're signing. I think that's basic common knowledge.
Okay, so that's common knowledge. What's the principle in law with respect to contracts? Isn't there an assumption that people are entering into contracts freely and voluntarily and with some level of knowledge and understanding?
Mr. Chairman, there is that assumption, and I think it's a good assumption to have. If consumer protection statutes are to assume that consumers are not ever going to take responsibility for their own actions, I think it would put an incredible burden on commerce as a whole.
So in what way does a Safeco insurance company or Blue Cross, how do they guarantee that the consumer knows what's in the contract, notwithstanding the fact that you have to file them with the insurance division and they're approved by the insurance division? How do you guarantee that the consumer actually knows what it is they're signing?
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, as you said, that this is highly regulated. Most of the provisions in the policy, virtually all of them, have been subject to scrutiny by the appropriate governmental agencies. The policies as drafted are fairly simple and consumer-friendly. I don't know if you've had occasion to read your policy lately, an automobile policy, for example. They've come a long way since, 20 or 30 years ago when one could not even understand even some of the more basic provisions. So from that standpoint, I believe that at least from the insurance company's perspective in regard to consumers, I believe that the policies as drafted are clear enough and simple enough for anybody to read it and to be able to question what's in there and possibly, arguably, negotiate, depending on what is subject to negotiation.
All right. And are you aware of any cases in Oregon with respect to insurance companies and directions by the court with respect to how contracts are written and the plain meanings of words and clauses and phrases?
I cannot cite a particular case, but yes, those cases do exist. I'd have to do some research on that to give you the particular case size.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
Senator Ringo.
You didn't really say the parties negotiate with the insurance companies for the terms of the policy.
No, I did not.
Okay. I thought you did. Thanks.
All right. Peggy, Annette.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. I have many of the concerns related to the health insurance contracts that have been previously described. Key to the questions that I have is that section that says that that applies to any contract provision that is not conspicuous and does not define the rights and obligations of the parties. As you've heard, insurance contracts are highly regulated and they are standardized. I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind that the language of this bill would apply to health insurance contracts. To get to the discussion related to binding arbitration, excuse me, you've heard that there have been there are now statutory requirements that set out an appeals process. In fact, in the contracts that I've looked at, many carriers that had binding arbitration before eliminated that because the appeals process, statutory appeals process in Oregon applying to health insurance contracts, essentially has to precede a binding arbitration process. It is a process through which an individual can question virtually any provision in a contract and then ultimately go to an external review authority. There is no charge to the insured for this. These provisions were actually enacted as part of the third iteration of patient protection in Oregon. Preceding that, we actually have gotten into statutory requirements outlining what an insured can ask in terms of information, disclosure about provisions such as network adequacy, claims processes, utilization review. There have been a whole host of issues that have been questioned related to health insurance policies that are now statutorily defined in terms of the type of information that is provided to the insurance buying public. The question I have in my mind, frankly, is whether or not anybody actually reads the information. But insofar as the disclosure provisions and the efforts to allow people that to go forward and question without any cost to them or dispute a provision of their contract, I think that's already exists in Oregon statute. Because of issues such as this, I would actually recommend that if you want more information on the insurance code provisions, we would be happy to provide that. But clearly, I would recommend that this bill omit health insurance policies. In addition to the issues that I just mentioned related to patient protection, you also get into the fact that when an employer signs an agreement with a carrier, that is a commitment to make their premium payments. You also have enrollment applications that an individual signs that allows for the release of medical information for them to receive reimbursement for their claims. Layered on top of this, we have some federal legislation related to privacy of health insurance. And I'm afraid that what this does is overlaying this on the current statutory structure, both state and federal, it creates complexities, and I'm not sure I could figure my way out of. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
If you can't figure it out, how are the consumers going to figure it out?
I keep on asking myself that.
Okay. Now, does your organization, your insurance companies use binding arbitration clauses?
Mr. Chair, because of Oregon's appeal process, the companies that I deal with have deleted their binding arbitration provisions and inserted the appeals process that's required by Oregon statute.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. All right. And Matt Farmer, Oregon Association of Realtors.
Chairman Minnis, members of the committee, Matt Farmer, I'm Associate General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors. We are opposed to Senate Bill 297 for the reasons that have already been discussed, but let me see if I can draw it together here. In real estate, arbitration is commonly used, both in sale agreements and in listing agreements and so on. Those arbitration clauses typically suggest arbitrators, but they allow choice. They're conspicuously displayed. On the sale agreement, they even carry a notice that this clause affects your legal rights and you should contact an attorney if you have concerns. We think 297 is just too broadly written. I understand some of the problems in industries that the drafters are trying to reach, but this approach I just don't think is workable. You do have the contracts clause problem because it reaches contracts that are already in existence. Perhaps that can be fixed. You do have the Federal Arbitration Act problem, and maybe that can be fixed by naming something as generic as choice of forum. Maybe not. It's not clear to me as an attorney that saying choice of forum will automatically incorporate arbitration. And I think that's a serious problem. But that's not the real problem. The real problem is this is a bad piece of legislation that isn't necessary. What we've been talking about is adhesion contracts. And Oregon law has long recognized the problems with adhesion contracts and therefore allows parties to challenge clauses when they are, in the court's opinion, unfair or unreasonable. And if you think back on the testimony of the proponents, you will note that there were times when one consumer challenged a clause and the clause didn't apply and they were able to go to court. In other cases, not. And that's exactly the point, is that adhesion contracts, yes, they're standard forms. Yes, they're presented by one party on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. But the other part of it is that, and this is the part that this bill ignores, that the clause in question be unfair or unreasonable in the circumstances and that the parties had unequal bargaining power. This bill ignores all of that and just challenges the idea of binding arbitration clauses. I think Senator Farioli had a very good point about what is it here between the choice of a jury trial and an arbitration that consumers should know about? And I think that's a very legitimate point. That's not this bill. There are problems with the jury system. Everybody is aware of the problems of the jury systems. That works to the advantage of some plaintiffs, not others. There are problems with the arbitration system. That works to the advantage of some and not others. I don't think it's fair to, and I have heard some attempts to impugn the reputation of particular arbitration providers here. I don't think that that's fair. Arbitrators, by and large, are impartial and do apply the law as they understand it. I don't think there's anybody here that isn't aware of the fact that lawyers will play on the emotions of on-school juries. Those are big issues. That's not this bill. What this bill does is creates a presumption against certain contract clauses across the board without analysis of whether, in this case or not, the provision is unfair or the parties did have unequal bargaining power. So I don't think that this is the right approach to the problem. And the clause here, or any other clause that is not express and conspicuous and does not define the rights and obligations of the parties, I'm sure drives every lawyer in this room crazy for real obvious reasons. We're talking about written contracts. Every provision in a written contract is express. Every one of them defines the rights and obligations of the parties. Therefore, what this says is that every clause in a contract must be conspicuous. Arguing about whether every clause in a contract is conspicuous is the Lawyer's Full Employment Act. And since now we're talking about every clause in a contract, we're talking really about the ability to challenge on a presumption that it is void every standardized contract in the state. That's just not workable. Yes, there's some problems here. Those problems, I think, have to do with notice and disclosure of arbitration clauses in consumer contracts. I don't think this bill reaches that problem. So that's why we're opposed to this particular piece of legislation. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Farmer, thank you very much. Any questions? Just, Mr. Farmer, I want to remind you, and I guess anybody else listening, the relating clause in this bill says relating to contracts.
So it can become anything we want relating to contract.
I understand.
So,
thank you.
Yeah. And I'm still troubled by the issue of binding arbitration clauses and the waiver of a person's right to jury trial, and maybe somewhere embedded in the adhesion contract concept, but it troubles me that it does that. Anyway, there you go. Julie, you're next.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council. You've heard most of our concerns already today. To reiterate, standardize the language proposed in this bill was regarding standardized contracts or standardized print within contracts is very far-reaching. You've heard how it will impact or could impact the health insurance community, the casualty insurance community. It would impact employment contracts, service contracts that you purchase when you might purchase something like a treadmill, and financial contracts, for example, credit card agreements. Virtually thousands of contracts would be impacted in a situation where the bill is written, would retailers, for example, be forced into a situation to negotiate individual contracts for the sale of each service contract associated with the sale of a treadmill. This bill is so broad and so far-reaching. Section 1C, which has been brought up already today, seems to apply to any other provision impacting the rights of the parties, not just arbitration. So, and Blue Cross Blue Shield brought this point up as well as PiggyNet. The bill may also apply to current contracts. It's not clear to us whether it does or not. And I think Senator Farioli brought up a good point. Arbitration is not a bad thing. It's often a good thing, and it's often a good thing for customers. We have heard today from proponents that sometimes arbitration is more expensive and more timely. From what I understand, in most cases, arbitration is often faster, and it provides a valuable consumer right, and that is the right to take institutions to arbitration when taking them to court might be cost prohibitive. So those are our comments. They aren't much different from what you've heard from other parties today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very much. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? Sir.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Financial Services Association. I think my written testimony should pass out, and I won't repeat that. I just wanted to make one additional point that affects financial institutions with respect to arbitration clauses and disclosures, and it's the final bullet in my written testimony. As you've heard with contracts of insurance, contracts that financial institutions make with consumers are also highly regulated, and in some cases, and including the folks I represent as members of the Oregon Financial Services Association, those contracts are pre-submitted for approval by DCBS, Department of Consumer and Business Services, just like an insurance contract. But the point I think I wanted to make is the conspicuousness issue, if there's a concern that arbitration clauses are not conspicuous, is a difficulty for all of us as we're writing contracts. I didn't bring a copy of an Oregon standard retail installment contract that our members use when people are financing cars or other kinds of personal property purchases. But we're beyond 8.5 by 11. We're down to 8.5 by 14. And in fact, some of those extra pieces are, in fact, to comply with the myriad of both state and federal disclosure requirements that we have, many of which say this provision must be more conspicuous than any other provision. That's under the Federal Truth in Lending Act. Certain disclosures must be. And state law that talks about certain disclosures which have to be in certain places in the contract to deal with late charges or prepayment penalties and other kinds of issues. So I would just caution that making a requirement to specify that if you're going to have an arbitration clause, it must be a particular kind of conspicuousness or in a particular place is relatively problematic from the consumer's perspective as well as the lender's perspective. I remember a number of years ago, and if you ask me where, I'll have to dig through old files to try to find it. I think it was a Consumer Product Safety Commission study about disclosure and warnings that we have as a society at the federal and state level required on various kinds of products and in various kinds of contracts. And the point of the study was is we may have reached the point where we have over-disclosed and consumers are no longer even reading the disclosures because they're just too voluminous. I think we are close to that point in some kinds of consumer financial requirements where the disclosures are so voluminous and so specific, and this one must be here of this point type, that it makes it very difficult for us to write understandable contracts. So I would just caution that point. I think the chair has raised an important point about the Oregon constitutional provision in the Federal Arbitration Act, and I wish I was better informed on that provision, but I think that needs exploring, and I will commit to, in fact, to be part of that exploration and try to answer some of those questions of how the Federal Arbitration Act plays into the Oregon constitutional provision on jury trial. I don't know the answer today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? There are none. Thank you very much. We have another person who's April McVeigh, Oregon Independent Automobile Dealers.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm very nervous. This is my first time. Monty King is in the House Transportation Committee, and I know that he had a written statement that he would want read. I would like to say that we have 850 members that are OIADA members, Oregon Independent Auto Dealers. All of those members are then National Independent Auto Dealers Association members, NIADA. So just a clarification on our membership. Arbitration clauses keep issues out of the court that can be settled without huge costs to the business community, who then have to pass these costs on to consumers. In the used car industry, these clauses are rarely used but are an important step in the resolution of claims by consumers. Arbitration claim judgments are rarely appealed by dealers if they go against them. Usually, if there is an appeal to arbitration, it is by a consumer, and the consumer then has their day in court. Taking these issues to court is a costly idea for everyone, consumers and dealers alike. The Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association urges your defeat of this legislation.
So, April, are you standing in for?
Yes.
Okay. So I won't ask any really tough questions or put you on the spot there. All right. And I guess for counsel, I guess the question I want to ask is, are these binding arbitration clauses, or are they? Is there ultimately access to the courts if there's an appeal of an arbiter's decision? That's kind of an important point. So. All right, and I think we're going to need to. Okay, could be either way. All right, thank you. Senator Rico.
I just want to make sure I understood your question. I mean, Mr. Chair, you asked whether these binding arbitration clauses were really binding or whether there was an appeal.
Right, exactly. Because I think I heard Ms. McVeigh indicate that someone could eventually have their day in court. But
well, I think by that she meant they had their, quote, day in court by having an arbitration.
All right, and is that clear? Is that what you were saying, or do you?
The way it is written, it says, usually, if there's an appeal of the arbitration, it is by a consumer, and the consumer then has their day in court.
Right.
I'm assuming
so that implies that there's some subsequent judicial action.
Right. I don't think that's accurate, but I would invite Mr. Paxer to come up here and testify if that's important right now.
I think it is important. Ms. Vig, if you could stand down, I'd bring Mr. Baxter back up and have him give us a couple closing remarks. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ringo. To respond to the specific question, these are typically binding arbitration agreements. That is, the arbitrator's decision is final. The Oregon statutes provide a very, very limited basis for appeal from these awards. They are not appeals of errors in conclusions of law or fact. The four or five grounds of appeal are only if there's manifest evidence of bias or corruption on the part of the arbitrator or arbitrators. It's not an opportunity for an appellate court to look back and see if the arbitrator made a mistake. With leave of the chair, I would also like to correct the record with respect to one statement I made. Exhibit C in my materials, I had said that document named the Arbitration Service of Portland as the only arbitral forum. It was pointed out to me that clause also makes reference to the American Arbitration Association.
Mr. Chair, Chair.
All right, thank you, Senator Furry.
Thank you. I'd also like to, you or Councilor both, to respond to a point that was made earlier, that a binding arbitration, it does not go into play unless both parties requested. Is that correct?
That was the NADA, the auto dealers bill or law in Congress. As it stands now, the Oregon statutes, which virtually mirror the federal statutes, if there is an agreement in the contract to arbitrate, then either party can enforce it according to the terms of the contract.
Okay, so that could be invoked by one party. One party may prefer to go to court, but the other party can force a binding arbitration.
Absolutely.
Okay, and you actually kind of muddy the waters in my mind here. How does it operate again?
I beg your pardon?
Yeah, well, you got a contract that has binding arbitration clause in it, correct? This for assumption. So, and there's a problem that arises. And I think I read in some of the material, if I was the purchaser and I decided, well, I really didn't like the outcome and I want to now litigate, and if I file litigation, the auto dealer or whomever it might be might assert that the binding arbitration clause preempts my ability to access the courts, and therefore I'm stuck with binding arbitration. So it's not really a choice by either party. It's not that I, as a consumer, could veto the authority or the power of the maker of the contract to not go to binding arbitration. To go
right. There. Chair Minnis, it's often said that arbitration is a creature of contract. In other words, we look to the contract to find out what the obligations of the parties are with respect to arbitration. So the parties are free to draft whatever rules or procedures they want to invoke or not invoke arbitration. The problem that arises is that in this situation, one party with much greater bargaining power is drafting all the procedures and provisions. And
okay, and then the last thing before we wind up, I'm just wondering whether or not the Federal Arbitration Act addresses the issue specific to binding arbitration as opposed to non-binding arbitration. In other words, if it talks about the issue of arbitration in general and there's no specificity between non-binding or binding arbitration, because one allows an appeal to court, the other one does not, so we need some clarification on that.
Right. I believe the Federal Act discusses arbitration generally. So it's going to enforce an arbitration clause that says you can appeal, the same way it's going to enforce an arbitration clause that says you can't appeal.
Okay. All right. And that's very important, too.
And Mr. Chairman, this is a comment. I mean, if it's non-binding, any parties may choose to arbitrate a case anyway for various reasons. Then they say, you know what, we are going to arbitrate this case after the district court.
Right. Well, and that's where I'm a little bit confused, because it appears to me that when you have these contracts of adhesion, it has a binding arbitration clause. It appears to me that consumers are, in effect, stuck in that on the assumption that they've entered into this freely and voluntarily, or a Hobbs choice issue, either take it or leave it. And it may be or will be that that's the case, but I'm not sure that works well. Anyway, thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Anyone else wishing to testify? All right, with that, we are adjourned.